For the week of July 12th, 2009, this is Showbiz Sandbox, Episode 11. Back in Los Angeles and happy to be here, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And now in San Diego, I'm Karen Woodward.
Joining us today is one of our usual playmates, although actually now that I say that word and it's coming out of my mouth.
I feel like I'm wearing bunny ears.
Yeah, exactly. I just realized as I was saying that, Hugh Hefner popped into my head and I went, maybe we have to find a better word than playmate. Play date? I don't know. I don't know what fits, but Michael Giltz.
I play date. Play date.
Michael Giltz, who is a freelance writer for such outlets as the Huffington Post and The Advocate and the New York Daily News, and there are too many outlets for me to even mention, is joining us today. And I'm actually really happy to be back in the United States, not because of the reason most people are happy to be home, which is they get to sleep in their own bed or they get to, I don't know, take a shower in their own bathroom or whatever whatever people are usually happy to be home for. I'm actually just happy that I can stop trying to record this podcast on the road using a USB mic and, you know, one laptop.
Well, I'm happy to be back home, too. I was just on a two-week road trip with my dad, traveling around the country, visiting siblings and going to his hometown. So I'm awfully glad to be back home as well.
Well, and I'm sorry, Michael, you're joining us again at a time where there just is not very much news going on. Absolutely nothing happened in the entertainment world this week.
You're being sarcastic, right?
Yes. I have found, people are telling me, after spending a month abroad in Europe, that my sarcasm does not translate. Apparently, it doesn't translate to English, because nobody seems to understand that I'm being sarcastic. Because, of course, as you know, Michael Jackson passed away about 3 weeks ago, or 2 weeks ago, June 26, 2009, and his memorial service was held this past Tuesday. It was the most watched event, or the second most watched event to ever occur online. The first most watched event was, thank goodness, we have our priorities straight here. That was the Obama inauguration. Millions of streams were downloaded on sites like CNN and MTV. It was one of the highest trafficked internet days on record.
I watched it in a hotel room, not in a hotel room, in a hotel lobby in Massillon, Ohio, with people standing. Everybody who walked by would stop and watch, and then watch the next day the replays of Brooke Shields' speech, which I thought was really great, and Paris Jackson and her tearful speech. It was clearly everybody stopped and saw, even my mother, my father, everybody saw some of it.
Well, I watched it online on CNN, which had the Facebook widget embedded in it, so you could watch it and at the same time watch people's reactions to it.
Facebook had 6,000 status updates per second. No, sorry, per minute, which is the most status updates per minute that site has ever had.
More status updates than when he actually died?
I believe so.
Wow.
I, on the other hand, was in Amsterdam. And I can tell you that there, at least the people I was around and in bars and cafes, they could have cared less. It was as if it was any normal day, which I guess it was. It was just nobody was watching it that I saw, which doesn't necessarily mean much, but it seemed to me that it did not make a huge impact in Holland.
Well, you know, there, not that many people went to the event either. I mean, they were expecting to have something like 500,000 people who didn't have tickets, they were going to be milling about outside the Staples Center, and I heard there was only like 1,000. I find that very odd.
Well, like with many things, Michael Jackson, maybe it was hyped more than it was real.
But the fun thing is we're going to speak to somebody who was not only at the event but backstage, David Wild.
That's right, David Wild from Rolling Stone magazine, a contributing editor, and of course he's a television writer. I'll get him on the line here in just a moment. Actually, I should probably get him on the line now. Hold on a second. Let me just dial him in. Okay, I've added David Wild to our chat here, and he is joining us by phone to discuss the biggest entertainment news event of the week, and that is, of course, as we've been discussing, the death of pop singer Michael Jackson on June 26th and his memorial service, which happened this week. David originally comes from the world of journalism, but recently he fell into television and he can't get up. His bio at the Huffington Post highlights his career as an Emmy-nominated television writer, a best-selling author, and a contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine. But what he really wants to do is write for free on the Huffington Post, kind of like Michael. Wild is producer of the Chris Isaac Hour on the Bio Channel. You can now follow David at twitter.com/wildaboutmusic. David also wants you to read his brand new book titled He Is, I Say, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love Neil Diamond, because it's very meaningful, and most importantly, he gets paid for that. David spent the weeks after Jackson's death helping Rolling Stone magazine put together their special tribute issue to the pop singer, and it's either out on newsstands now or is coming out on newsstands shortly. David was also called on by Ken Ehrlich, who he has worked on the Grammy Awards with for a number of years, to help put together Tuesday's Michael Jackson Memorial at the Staples Center in Los Angeles, along with choreographer-director Kenny Ortega, Randy Phillips, and of course, the Jackson family. As he wrote in his piece on the Huffington Post, David's first reaction to being summoned to assist with what is sure to be the memorial service of the decade was having, quote, absolutely no idea what to expect, which was okay, because too often in television, you know exactly what to expect, and you end up being right, end quote. David, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. I can just listen to the intro all day. I became a big fan of myself.
Your bio...
Yeah, I was just going to say, okay, David, time's up, bye.
Yeah, exactly. That was great. Thank you, everybody.
As I was writing it, I thought, well, it's okay, 2 or 3 paragraphs. That might be a little long, but...
No, I enjoyed it, believe me. I can listen to things about me all day. My wife would confirm that.
Well, now, how long have you been working with Rolling Stone? It seems like quite a while.
It was the Iron Age, I believe. No, it was... I literally came right out of college in the 80s, yes, and went right to Esquire magazine for 2 years, and then in the back half of the 80s, I came to Rolling Stone, and I've been working for them in a different capacities on and off since then. Now I'm just a contributing editor, which means, you know, when Michael Jackson died, I got the call, like, help, and spent the next week talking to tracking down Stevie Wonder, Smokey Robinson, Lionel Richie, Donny Osmond, Stevie Nicks, you know, and all sorts of people who I've interviewed over the years, and helping them, you know, put together their comments and tributes to Michael for the special issue, which is out and which I hear is great. I say I hear because it's apparently so in demand they haven't sent me one yet. And I haven't bought one because on principle, on a religious conviction. I haven't bought one yet.
Well, that's funny because you're not going to buy a Rolling Stone magazine, but yet you'll write for the Huffington Post, which pays oh so well, as Michael Giltz can tell you. Michael, of course, also writes for the Huffington Post, among the many other outlets, including the New York Daily News. And what other outlets do you write for, Michael?
Well, I wrote for The Advocate, but they just got rid of their entertainment editor. His contract came up for renewal, and they said thank you very much and let him go, and they're not replacing him. So that tells you one more indication of what kind of a recession we're in. I mean, The Advocate magazine, it's a gay and lesbian magazine, Arts and Entertainment is half their publication. So when they don't have an Arts and Entertainment editor, you know that that's a pretty telling sign. But David, you know,
In their defense, you know, Arts and Entertainment are really not popular in the gay community.
That's right. And I was not looking forward to the memorial. I was worried it would be some god-awful train wreck. It might be a grand – who knew what it would be like? And I have to congratulate you and the people who worked on it, because it was really, as almost everyone has agreed, very tasteful and well done.
Well, you know what? Thank you. You know, and a lot of that really does, I have to say, beyond Ken Ehrlich and Kenny Ortega and Randy Phillips and the whole team, some of the key decisions – go back to the family. We were talking most to Randy Phillips, who was sort of our contact person for a lot of questions. But also Michael's mother, Catherine, had a couple of very important contributions to keeping it, I think, setting the right tone. For instance, you know, she was the one who reached out to Maya Angelou to write that poem, which Queen Latifah read, which I thought it just sort of elevated it above and sort of lent a certain seriousness. And I believe it was also she was the one who really sort of insisted, I think, that the casket be there, which was something that, you know, it's not the sort of thing that you could ask, but she felt, I think it sort of lent the event a sort of seriousness. Because, you know, when you get into the Staples Center and you start giving away tickets, it could have become a circus, which, by the way, the circus was on the side of the stage. They were moving the circus in, like, I'm not joking. A half an hour later, there were backstage, there were elephants and lions and tigers.
Michael would have loved that.
Michael would have loved, absolutely loved, I'm sure. So it was just it was quite an interesting event. I usually in TV you have weeks to prepare for things, and the only other thing that's, and it's not a comparable event, but no, I was the head writer for the Tribute to Heroes, the 9/11 telethon, and that was the only thing where you've tried to pull something off in 3 or 4 days, and it seems to, sometimes you just need a certain amount of time to, that kind of time challenge can help you focus.
I was going to mention that because you were Emmy nominated for your work on that special America, A Tribute to Heroes, which was the 9/11 special all the network showed. And that struck absolutely the right tone. I've watched it on DVD since then. And the way it was structured and written and flowed was really beautifully done. So it's not a surprise.
I'll tell you, part of the reason for that, this is a little known story, is that my wife, who you might hear in the background, because my kids just got back from camp, when Joel Gallen, who produced that, got the call from the network to do the event, he called me, my wife picked up, heard there was going to be a telethon, and started yelling at him, this was a horrible idea, that this is not about the stars. Basically, the open that I ended up writing for Tom Hanks, who opened that event, was based on the things my wife was yelling at Joel Gallen. and I think her sort of outrage at the idea of it made us sort of keep it a non-show-busy event. We didn't even introduce anyone, which, by the way, there weren't introductions on the memorial either.
That's right.
It's sort of like you have to break from showbiz convention if you're not dealing with show business. If you want to, I think we're also used to those conventions. And now, please welcome, ladies and gentlemen.
Grammy winning.
Yeah, it just, you have to sort of set a different tone, which I think Ken Ehrlich and Kenny Ortega all sort of, figured out how to do that.
Well, certainly it was portrayed in the media as being a star-studded event.
Oh, no, and listen, if it wasn't a certain, I think Michael was show business and glamour and music, but I think the thing that I'll remember is that when it was done, I was online, and I think it was the Variety wrote about the event and said, used the word dignity, and I thought, well, this is great, because I think as someone who I didn't, I was around Michael, I didn't really know him in any serious way, but I loved his music and was sort of very, had loved him music for years. I felt that his contribution to our culture had gotten completely lost because of his celebrity. I think, and that was some of that was a self-inflicted wound, certainly. He wasn't blameless in that at all. But I still felt, at the end of his life, he deserved a serious, sort of reflection of what he had contributed.
Well, actually, in your post on the Huffington Post, that's kind of hard to say with two posts being in that sentence.
Yeah, I know.
And this is very typical of your writing, which I think is fantastic. And you write, and I quote this, "Unlike celebrity, death is real. Celebrity, which Michael Jackson experienced in its purest and perhaps most dangerous form, may be the dominant religion of our times, but it is one that openly sells false gods and offers little lasting solace. Celebrity helps sell lots of magazines and commercial time, but celebrity does not trump blood. Michael Jackson was not just a great artist, he was somebody's brother, and as such, he deserved a proper send-off."
Well, thank you. I like me even more now. but I part of the fact is that, and I think I mentioned it in that post, is that I had the experience of my brother and I and my sister burying my father this year. And I think it sort of does inform your sense of how do you sum up a life. And, I actually have had some people say, how come no one said he was a dirtbag? that's generally not the tone set at a, I think, there's going to be, we know how the media is. We're part of the media, and there will be ugly things said, and he will be judged harshly. But I think there is a time for, those who love someone. And by the way, one of the things I have to say is, between Rolling Stone and the event, I spoke to some of these people who knew Michael the best, and they sincerely loved him. Now, some of them, for whatever reasons, Michael was not an easy man to have access to in his later years. But every one of them, and some of these people I've known for years, their love of this guy and their sense that he was a man with a good heart, it came through really loud and clear. And I, you know, I take that seriously. Like, I've interviewed Smokey Robinson a great deal over the years, and Stevie Wonder I know fairly well, and I work with a lot. And these guys, they weren't just saying it for a eulogy. They were really, I mean, Stevie in particular, Stevie Wonder was truly, it was a hard bit of news for him to handle. And I think when he sang, and by the way, I thought he was absolutely fantastic in his performance, the sort of two songs that he did. But he said, this is something I wish I hadn't lived to see. And I know that that was real. That wasn't some line on stage. That was something he really felt. He had, he was the last person, I interviewed him for his tribute in the Rolling Stone tribute issue. He's the last person we got because he just wasn't even ready to speak until midnight of the night before it went to print.
Well, I know that you mentioned that, you know, a lot of these people were his friends and they just didn't have access to him. That was one of the things that Nikki Fink, the columnist and blogger for Deadline Hollywood, her blog, she wrote, I guess it was at some point during the week, she had kind of had enough after the memorial service, and she wrote a post headlined Enough, and she says, "Who else is sickened by the amount of time and space which the media have devoted to Michael Jackson? What a shameless exploitation of a death for readers and ratings, and I'd like to know where most of the celebrity friends on stage today were when the singer was in legal and financial trouble. What a bunch of camera-hogging hypocrites. It's just wrong, 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 wrong."
I disagree. I think, and in fact, I think the people who couldn't get in, who weren't in touch with Michael, I think they weren't, they were all trying, and most of the ones that I know were people who wanted to be in touch with him. But I think the nature of the life he was leading and the people who he was dealing with, I think a lot of people, I think access became power for some people, and they were, and some of them did have, I mean, Donny Osmond told me some stories about recent years and trying to reach out to him, and he actually told me the story, I think it might be an issue, I'm not sure, but he had, Stevie Wonder he had seen a couple of years ago, and Stevie had said, "You've got to get close to Michael, he needs a friend," and I think people did try to reach out, but I think the nature of Michael's life and his finances and whatever other issues, I think he led an isolated life, and I think that he paid the ultimate price for that isolation in the end.
Well, did you read Robert Hilburn's article in the LA Times? Because it kind
I'm
of
not ready yet.
It kind of touches on that a bit, that effectively that his celebrity wound up being his savior initially, and then ultimately it just crossed the line and wound up killing him.
Well, and Robert Hilburn, I beg your pardon, Robert Hilburn also echoes what David was saying, that he was friends with Michael, was ghostwriting his autobiography, and that when he said something that Michael didn't like, Michael cut him off, and even though he tried to reach out and be a friend to him or, you know, maintain a relationship, it wasn't possible. I thought Nikki Fink's post was very silly. When one of the biggest celebrities in the world dies, you're going to have a ton of news coverage for a week or two. It's just going to happen.
Yeah, you know, Lionel Richie told me that I think this will be in the Rolling Stone issue, that, you know, basically he feels like Michael, when he was eventually surrounded himself with children as much as possible, it was in part because he didn't, we all need people to say no, and Michael eventually eliminated people who would say no. And so, I mean, I was even with Quincy Jones a few years back. Michael had me interview Quincy for little audio bits that are on reissues of Thriller and Off the Wall and Bad. And at that point, Quincy was telling me, who's a great guy, and by the way, someone who I think Michael could have trusted, didn't want anything from Michael, Quincy said he could not get in touch with him at that point. This is like 7 years ago, I'm not sure. But it just struck me, there's something wrong if Quincy can't get to Michael Jackson, because it's like and frankly, the people I was speaking to for the tribute issue in Rolling Stone, the Smokey Robinsons, the Lionel Richies, these are people who I think didn't wish Michael anything but the best and kind of people he could have trusted. And it's sad to say, it's not for me to guess, but I think there's something, you know, I think that's part of the problem, is that he was isolated from people, you know, some people who had his best interest at heart.
Well, now, one of the things you mentioned is that in your post is that behind all of these stories, and I'll quote, there are actual people on the other side of what we write about and what we do. And I guess you put it best just a few moments ago when you said, you know, there are times for, you know, skewering somebody, and there are times for honoring their life.
Well, I'll tell you what Stevie Wonder said to me very explicitly was that there are people, like our media universe, he said, there is this sort of ugly drift in our society. And he said, in music it got criticized that certain rappers were using bad words and demeaning women. He said, but the media has to look at itself, too, and say that the media has turned uglier. And he said, some people are too sensitive to live to survive it. He actually said it's like the TMZs of the world that Michael could not survive. And when I came to Rolling Stone, I remember, I'm sorry, my kids are just back from camp if it's noisy. I remember when I was editing the first cover story I edited on Michael at Rolling Stone, there was a telling fact that he had written $100 million, that number, on his bathroom mirror in lipstick.
I remember that.
Oh, yeah. Donny Osmond actually told me he saw it written on his mirror when I talked to him recently. And that struck me as, I think Michael started going to the tabloids and the whole Elephant Man, all of that ridiculousness was part of him trying to use the tabloid media to get to go be even bigger than big, to make himself the biggest star of all time. And I think in the end, he got eaten alive by that reaching out to that kind of celebrity that was unhealthy. It overwhelms his musical talent, which is crazy because he was on a purely musical level, maybe the greatest singer, dancer of our lifetime. And yet that got obscured for me and for, I think, lots of other people for a long time by the celebrity and his other problems.
I think that's why the black community has embraced him so strongly, because now that he's dead, he can't embarrass them anymore. Now they can actually celebrate his music again, because for the last 10 years, 15 years, he hasn't made a lot of really great music, and he keeps doing things. He seems to be unhappy about his skin color. Quincy Jones said he didn't want to be black, and he was getting child molestation charges and paying people tens of millions of dollars to keep them from suing him over improprieties with their children and living this strange, odd life. And I think it was hard to appreciate and enjoy his music. And now he's gone, you can sort of embrace that again and not worry about him doing something that'll make you feel stupid for enjoying his work.
I think you might be right, and I think there is this kind of disconnect, because I know when I was speaking to Smokey Robinson, at one point I said something like, it's kind of amazing how I find myself listening to the music when, frankly, I haven't for the last decade all that often because of the various celebrity insanity. And Smokey was shocked by what I said, and I thought, well, maybe that's part of there's a disconnect, and maybe white America in particular, I think his place was sort of obscured for so long. Whereas it doesn't seem to be the case in England and Europe. From what I hear, Michael's music has never really faded in terms of impact. Now, and I think maybe because, I can't quite explain it, but there seems to be, I think he alienated white America for a long time. And in death, certain things have been forgiven, or even more horribly, to imagine that he's a guy who was more sinned than sinned against. I'm sorry. I think there is a chance that we were all judging him in the harshest possible way, and maybe there's a, I'm not saying innocent explanation, but there are more innocent explanations for, you know, the last 10 years.
Well, certainly the memorial service will be remembered for quite some time. Were there any challenges putting it together?
I mean, I think any event where you're trying to put anything together in a couple of days, there's a lot of challenges. But I'd have to say that because everyone had a proper motivation to, I think everyone pulled together, and Ken Ehrlich and Kenny Ortega and Randy Phillips, and, you know, there were just a few of us over the weekend trying to sort of, put it together. And it was challenging, and there was very, people generally for performances on a stage, you want to have a lot of rehearsal, but there was not a lot of time for anything. But I think usually these things work out worse than you expect, and the event to me, took on its own sort of tone, and the family contributed to that proper tone. We did not, for instance, know that, like, people would walk down and the family would, you know, greet the speakers and there'd be sort of a moment like that. We didn't know, we certainly did not know that the children would be there. And we did definitely did not know that, you know, his daughter would speak. I can tell you that I was on the side of the stage, and someone asked me if those were his children, and I didn't even know if they were, because, you know, I personally, as a parent myself, I would never ask that question about whether the children would be there, and it's not my business. And so, yeah, there was a lot of it. It just it became what it should become, which was a memorial. It wasn't, and that was one thing Ken Ehrlich said to us again and again: it's not a TV show. And it wasn't run like a TV show, and I think that was probably why it was powerful, because we're all used to, you know, things becoming TV and becoming easily digestible in that form. It sort of was what it needed to be.
Well, okay, two points there then, because certainly there was some debate as to whether the whole Paris Jackson getting on stage and making that very emotional speech, and it was probably one of the most touching moments of the entire memorial service, whether that was planned or not. And Roger Friedman, who writes a column for The Hollywood Reporter and a blog for The Hollywood Reporter, he said that from his vantage point, it did not look like it was planned at all. And so you're kind of confirming that by being one of those people who helped put the show together, and it wasn't planned from what you're just saying.
I'll confirm 100%. We totally had no sense. I have no idea if someone in the family said something during the event, or it seemed to me, as even when I didn't see it on television since, you know, I was there, but as I recall, I think one of the brothers said, Janet wants to say something, and it just sort of seemed to happen. But trust me, I will say that was something we had no idea would happen. We did not even know if the children were going to be at the event. I think we suspected not.
Well, you know, there's certainly after she spoke and all the pictures of her afterwards, both, you know, the video images and the still images, of course, everybody's pointing out, hey, she's got blue eyes, which is biologically and genetically close to impossible if she were Michael Jackson's, I guess, biological child. You know, in a way that kind of helped spur debate, even though it was supposed to be an incredibly heartfelt moment.
Yeah, I'm a parent, and I personally, I would like to leave the kids alone. I only wish them, you know, again, that was sort of the point of the Huffington Post blog was, you know, he was someone's father, and I think that's what the people who I spoke to after the event, that was really what hit them, that he was, the phrase I heard again and again was that he was humanized.
Absolutely. I would have to agree with that.
And that's what I mean by celebrity as a religion, as a fetish, is what else do we think he is? I mean, as, you know, I think he played the game and played up the what became known as the Wacko Jacko angle. But truthfully, it's like, we shouldn't be surprised that anyone is a human being, but we are. I mean, and I see it time and time again in my business. You know, when people meet a Beatle or they meet, you know, some other rock star or even like a president, they go, I can't believe he's just a person. You know, and it's like, I don't know what, if we, it shouldn't be such a great logical leap to realize that Michael was human. And I mean, and it doesn't take, as from my point of view, you know, you see, I mean, I think celebrity to a child can be very damaging. I think, obviously, from my point of view, Michael paid a high price for it, and it seemed to shape his whole life. I mean, from talking to his friends, you know, it's like Lionel Richie told me something really interesting. He said, because I was talking to him about, he was at the recording session when Paul McCartney recorded The Girl Is Mine with Michael for Thriller. And
The weakest track on the album.
I'm sorry?
The weakest track on the album.
Yes. But
kind of Thriller was the weakest track on his album?
No, The Girl Is Mine.
But what Lionel said was, he goes, even with me and Paul McCartney, and he goes, if you put us in a room and any other group of guys, we would eventually go to normal guy discussion, like the first girl you ever loved, the first fight you ever got in. He goes, Michael is one of the only people who could never have a regular guy discussion, because he said all of us at 18 were probably leading something like a normal life, and then fame hit in different ways and different times. But he said Michael never had any of that. And I think Brooke Shields sort of got at that point, that he was a slacker by not getting anything, you know, not singing until he was 4 or 5.
So then what do you make of the media hoopla, the chaos surrounding all of this? I mean, on one hand, he's a person. On one hand, he's clearly one of the biggest celebrities ever.
I'll tell you exactly what it is. I was at CNN. I was appearing on CNN the weekend before the memorial a couple of times, and I was there when they got the initial ratings. And I believe ratings were up 100% or something like that. And so that's what this is all about. It's delivering ratings for the media at a time when the media, it's like, this is like a stimulus plan for the media. That's what it is. And and as a result, they'll call people like me or people who know less than me, if that's possible, and they'll keep doing it until the ratings go down. That's what's happening.
So how do you keep from being a cynic?
I mean, I just try to say what I think and not, you know, I was actually on CNN a couple, maybe last weekend, the first weekend afterwards with Michael, the Jackson 5's former manager. And I said to him, if they ask us a question that we don't care about, we'll answer a question we care about, because I don't want to be part of the demeaning Michael particularly. The things that he may have done right or wrong, I don't know. What I do know is the music, and I do know that that music is transcendently great. You know, and I know that the music has brought me a lot of joy, and as long as you can keep it as much as possible based on the artistry of the man, then I'm more comfortable. It's like, because other than that, I think, listen, let Jeffrey Toobin, who I was on with another time, let Jeffrey Toobin examine the legal realities. I don't know. I did not go to law school, and I made a big point of trying to avoid it, so I don't want to be one of the legal eagles.
I think every single entertainment journalist could say the same thing, that we've all done our best to try and avoid law school.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I was going to say, speaking of music that is just, you know, transcendent, I want to talk about the book, Neil Diamond.
That'd be great.
It's called He Is, I Say, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love Neil Diamond, which is a paraphrase of the best and worst line of Neil Diamond's career. And I hear you're also working on a TV special about him?
Well, Neil has recorded a concert last August at Madison Square Garden, a sort of homecoming show, and there'll be a CBS special of that in August that I'm helping with right now. In fact, I was in the editing room when we heard the news of Michael, and then I had like a week and a half of Michael Jackson, and I was happy at the end of this week to return to the editing room and to spend a couple of days watching Neil Diamond, which I've spent, you know, basically since childhood I've been watching Neil Diamond. So he was, you know, just again, it's, you all have your gateway drug, and he was my gateway drug into music. My mom played him on 8-track tapes when I was a little kid, and that was like, I think, the moment when I realized, I like these things called songs, you know. It may have even been like Song Sung Blue when I was like 5 or 6, hearing that on an 8-track tape. And by the way, nothing sounds better than the Sonics of an 8-track tape. So Neil was very important to me growing up. And then by weird coincidence, you know, during the writer's strike last year, his manager invited, Katie McNeil invited me to hear his last record early. And I heard it, and I remember just thinking, this guy deserves a book. Like, so what I did was I wrote a book that is 3/4 about Neil Diamond and the other quarter is about me. And it's about, I'm frustrated with a lot of music biographies because I think that they in seeking to be objective, they sometimes read like just one big Wikipedia entry. And to me, music is so personally important that I sort of did a odd combination of a memoir and a biography. So it's sort of a very personal tribute to Neil Diamond. And if you like him, you're going to get his story. But and if you hate me, you're going to be in trouble because you're going to hear some of my story. And then in certain places, the actual open of the book is the night that Neil Diamond invited my mother backstage. And you'd have to read the book to find out exactly what happens. But
What's your favorite song?
You know, that's by Neil. I'm a big fan right now because I'm watching versions that he did, you know, recently. I love the song called Brooklyn Roads. I love Solitary Man, always have. I love a song called And the Grass I Won't Pay No Mind that actually Elvis covered. I love Play Me, which Bono has covered. But I like a lot of them. You know, in the right rare patriotic mode, I can even sing along to America.
Oh, I love that song.
In any mode, I can sing along to that.
That's my karaoke number.
Oh, yeah.
Totally.
But the great thing about Neil Diamond is that his last two albums, 12 Songs and Home Before Dark, I think are unquestionably the best albums of his career. And for various technical and corporate reasons, they didn't have quite the commercial success they probably should have. And they're both, he's just really in his prime right now.
Oh, no, I'm so glad you point that out. Yeah, I actually think the last record is his best album ever, which is remarkable.
Yeah.
The record before it has a song called Hell Yeah that is just a classic.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, and that's one of my favorite songs ever by him. And I think he's rediscovered himself as a writer, and that was part of... I find that very... It's just a... See anybody hitting a peak at his age is really impressive to someone who's... I'm younger than he is, but not by that enough. So, you know, it helps keep you honest that you can still be doing your best work. In his case, you know, at his age, he's doing the best work of his life, and... I find that very encouraging because ultimately as you get older and like I'm a parent and I have kids who are, you know, 9 and 11, married guy, and I like, you know, the Kurt Cobain myth of self-destruction, or not even a myth, but the, you know, the obliteration of self becomes less romantic as you become, you know, I'm in my 40s now and I love Kurt Cobain, but I don't find that much of an encouraging role model.
Well, that's what's so great about Neil Diamond is that he was always so self-accepting. And that's why I listen to him, is because he always makes me feel good about myself.
Hell yeah. Yeah. Hell yeah.
Which is what that song is sort of about. It's like, it's all worth it. And that's why I love that song.
Well, I've heard people who have seen him recently in concert that he is one of the best live performers out there today, rivaling people like Bruce Springsteen and U2 and Pearl Jam.
Oh, I've just spent days watching footage from this, and Hamish Hamilton is a very talented director who does a lot of stuff with Coldplay and U2, and Peter Gabriel shot this event. And, you know, plus Neil is wearing, I got to tell you, it's like, you know, Johnny Cash recorded Solitary Man right before the end, you know, towards the end of his life. And I think now that Johnny's gone and Neil is sort of wearing, he's become the Men in Black. He's not really wearing the glass bead shiny shirts as much as he's wearing black. And he's sort of taken, I can't explain it, but he's just sort of, he has his mojo back. And, you know, I met Neil in 1988 when I was, you know, right out of school. And it wasn't artistically the peak of his career. And that's why to have 20 years later, he's back at the peak of his career. That's a shining example. And this show is going to be, I mean, the DVD that's going to come out of it will have the whole show. The CBS special will only have some of the highlights and some other interesting segments, but it's going to be a great, I think for anyone who loves Neil, and I'm proud to count myself among them, it's going to be, you know, a real treat.
And when is it on?
August,
hot August night.
Hot August night, NYC. I'd have to check the net. I think it's August. I don't want to give you the wrong date, but if you go to his website, you can find out. And it's, I think, the same day that the DVD comes out, and it's going to be great.
And is your book out already? Has it been published?
The book is out.
Yeah.
My book is out and about, and it's called "The As I Say: How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love Neil Diamond." You can order it at Amazon, I think it comes out in England in paperback sometime this summer, and then it's still out in hardcover. I think it won't come out in paperback in America till Christmas, but I would, you know, if it was a labor of love, you know, Neil once told me, he goes, "David, this book is your Solitary Man," which to me is the best review I'll ever, I can't get a better review than that. I think maybe he just means no one will talk to me.
No, exactly. This book is the end of your career.
Exactly. I got to work out, next book will be my Cherry Cherry, that means.
Oh, yeah.
Well, were you very happy that, or relieved, I should say, not happy, that during this, what must have been a hectic 2 weeks for you, your children were off at summer camp?
But no, it was actually just by pure weird coincidence. My son was at camp, a tennis camp, about 8 feet from the hospital where Michael died. So he was literally buzzed by helicopters for the day of Michael's death right before he went away. So, you know, this in L.A., this has been driving around our neighborhoods. It's just been amazing the impact that this has had. And you sense people are now moving on, and I only hope that, you know, listen, there's a lot to worry about and think about. But I don't think there's, you know, I'm old enough to remember as a kid when Elvis died, and I think there is something to assessing your icons. And in Michael's case, at least, you know, I think I'm someone who loved him and hadn't thought about the music for years, so I'm glad I had a week or two to really think about that music and live with it again.
Well, certainly we appreciate you coming on and telling us all about what it was like to work on that memorial, and hopefully dispensing some of the rumors. And I don't know if that's the right word, dispensing some of the rumors. That would mean you're actually propagating.
Dispelling.
Thank you.
And I agree. I know. My pleasure talking to you. A pleasure talking to you. And yeah, and I just want to say that I think obviously there's a time for cynicism. It just, to me, it wasn't the time. It was, you know, there'll be a lot more time for cynicism in the days to come. It's sort of like after the election. I think it's nice that Fox News gives a day or two before they start trying to hate the president full time. So it's like, I think we have to, we should honor our, honor the fallen before we attack them again.
And Neil Diamond, Hot August Night NYC, airs on CBS Friday, August 14th at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Thank you for coming up with that. It's going to be great. It's going to be, I have to say, I'm watching things over and over again, and I just can't get enough.
Well, we look forward to seeing it.
Nice talking to you.
Thank you very much, David. That was very nice of David to join us. I know that he has had a hectic, unbearable, I don't want to say unbearable, but he's had a very busy 2 weeks.
He certainly has.
I think is interesting is that, he reminds us to be, you know, real humans at a time like this when, you know, I am extremely guilty of being a complete cynic, and it's kind of nice to see the sincerity in somebody who's there.
Well, yeah, I guess what he's saying is, look, at the end of the day, the guy was a human being, and faults, warts, and all, he was a human being that had 3 children, whether they were biologically his or not. And I think that given what we saw of Paris Jackson and her blue eyes, that's probably the stories that she is not his biological daughter are probably more true than not.
Well, she could have contact lenses. I mean, we have no idea.
Yeah,
I mean, we know as much as anybody else about whether she's his biological daughter. And if she wasn't, I imagine it would have come out in the last few years. I'm suspicious of any new rumor that comes up in the week after someone dies. It's almost always malarkey.
And you know what? It doesn't really matter. As David Wilde pointed out, he was their father, period. And
well, but doesn't it matter that he was presumably a pedophile?
Okay, that, yes, I will say.
But he was acquitted of that, so.
No. He paid more than $10 million to the family of a boy that he molested.
In the 1990s.
And he could describe his penis. He was not acquitted of that. He paid people off so that he didn't go to trial in a civil court. He was acquitted of a later trial by a family of grifters that tried to rip him off that perhaps was not substantiated. But he himself says, oh, I share beds with children. It's beautiful and wonderful. Why doesn't everyone do that? You know, and he's paid more than $10 million to families of children that accused him of molesting them. So, I mean, you know, I dealt with in-laws, and I'm sort of on your side where I was sort of like, well, you know, we just want to talk about his music now. That's all over with. You know, but I've had in-laws and other people going, why are we talking about this guy? He's, you know, he molests children. And, you know, it's a good argument.
I definitely see both sides.
And I still think...
My initial instinct was, oh my God, thank God he's gone, as horrible as that is.
Yeah.
But then you started listening to people playing his music, you know, in my apartment building or like in the cars. And then you're like, guys, music really was pretty good. But not lately.
Well, that's very true, and I still think that anybody who really wants to know what it was like to at least, know Michael Jackson over the course of more than 3 decades should read the piece on Michael Jackson, written by Robert Hilburn, who was the Times pop music critic from 1970 to 2005. We'll place links to it in the show notes. It was written the weekend after his death, Michael Jackson's death. And a part of it was taken from Corn Flakes with John Lennon and Other Tales from a Rock and Roll Life, which is a book Hilburn will be publishing in October of this year. It's a very fascinating look at somebody who he met Michael Jackson when he was 11 years old and knew him right up until about 10 years before his death. And he just saw how, as David was mentioning, how much he changed over time.
I don't excuse anything he did as an adult, because other people get abused and treated terribly and don't go on to, you know, do bad things. They leave good lives. But it is hard. It is easy to forget that, you know, this guy has been clearly physically abused and treated horribly and taken advantage of by almost everyone around him since he was a little boy.
That's true. And I guess look, he's been famous since he was a little boy, and it's close to 4 decades. And I guess that's why it's such a big news story. So big, in fact, that there's absolutely no other news to talk about this week other than Michael Jackson.
What about the box office?
Did they show movies this weekend? Well, yes.
Karen, did you go see The Proposal this weekend?
She saw it 2 weekends ago.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
I missed it. How stupid of me. What about Bruno?
The Proposal is a bad movie, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Did you see Bruno?
No, that type of humor my sense of humor doesn't go there. I find that really silly and stupid, so I'm not likely to go.
Well, a lot of people disagree with you, I guess, or they do find that kind of humor somewhat appealing, because it made $30.4 million over the 3-day weekend. It came in first place, edging out Ice Age Dawn of the Dinosaurs, which is Ice Age 3, which made $28.5 million on 4,100 screens. It dropped only 31.6%, which is quite good. To date, it's made $120.5 million.
Have either one of you guys seen Bruno?
I was out of the country. That's my excuse.
I did see Bruno. It was painfully unfunny. It really was. It's kind of fascinating, because it's exactly the same movie as Borat, down to plot twists. And, you know, we begin with a fake bio of Bruno. We go to America. He wants to become famous. He has a sidekick. The sidekick leaves him at a crucial moment. Instead of going to a rodeo like he did in Borat, he goes to a mixed martial arts event. You know, it's just literally, you can connect the dots to scene after scene from each movie. The difference is just that this one is just remarkably unfunny. And I think a lot of it probably has to do with the fact that it's just not an interesting character. You know, Borat is sort of hapless and sweet, and Bruno is just sort of fame hungry and obnoxious. And,
or do you think that we're just getting tired of Sacha Baron Cohen's shtick?
Well, I never liked Bruno in the TV show, so I never thought it would make as interesting a movie. And that's proven. I don't think he's necessarily done, but just wasn't as interesting a character. And he couldn't do Borat again because he was too well known. So he did Bruno. But it's just an obnoxious, you know, exposing the shallowness of a fashionista celebrity reporter isn't exactly big news. But I think people agree with Karen, because it had a terrible Saturday. Initially, it was supposed to do better this weekend based on the Friday numbers. But everybody who saw it on Friday apparently told people on Saturday that it was awful,
because
the numbers went down the way they shouldn't have. And so that's bad word of mouth. And the movie's going to drop off a cliff next weekend. I would be shocked if it didn't.
Well, think about it. Bruno made $15 million, or close to $15 million on Friday, which usually means that you could predict a $35, $40, $45 million opening. And it just did not do that.
Yeah.
It dropped off from Friday to Saturday, as you pointed out. Transformers also dropped off this week, 42.8% from last weekend. It made $24.2 million. And in the first 14 days, it surpassed $300 million in the United States. In North America, Canada, and the United States. It's made $339.2 million to date. I'm still trying to find a place for us to get international grosses, because we do have international listeners.
You know, it's interesting, because I don't know anybody who has seen Transformers who thinks it's a good movie.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
I feel bad for the kids who this is their big franchise, Harry Potter and Transformers. And I think the first movie, they were so excited it was a movie, they went to see it. The second one, I think they've gone because they were hoping it would be good. And I think the third one is not going to perform as well because you just can't keep making really, really bad movies and have people keep coming to them.
That I would agree with you on that. I think the third one would be a disaster. I don't think it would be nearly as big as this one.
It will only make $400 million worldwide.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
But it'll take 21 days. Public Enemies came in fourth place with $14.1 million. To date, it's made $66.5 million in North America, which is...
Michael, have you seen that?
Yes, I have.
And?
And?
I had a lot of problems with it. I like the actors in it. Who is it? Stephen Lang, I think, is really good in a small role as a sidekick to the Christian Bale character. But it's a very confused movie. If they'd just chosen one of the stories, they might have done it. If they'd chosen the story of the FBI or the story of the rise of the mob and how gangsters like John Dillinger became outdated, that would have been a good movie. If they'd chosen the story of this romance between John Dillinger and the girl, or the story of Hoover trying to get the FBI formed, you know, but they have little, you have glimpses of all these different storylines and none of them come to fruition. And the big problem, I think, is Marion Cotillard. She has this French accent. I mean, it's sort of vaguely explained in the movie, but it's very distracting how she keep, you know, her accent is okay at times, but it's very clear that it's not her first language. You can hear the way she phrases sentences and speaks. The rhythm is just slightly off, and I don't understand why they cast her. It just was not a good idea.
Wait, all those storylines were in one movie?
Yeah, and none of them fully developed. You could sort of say, oh, they might have done that movie, they might have done this movie, they might have done another movie, but they didn't. They did. I think there's probably some 4-hour cut out there, maybe, but it was not. None of them were satisfying because Dillinger isn't very bright in the movie. You know, he's not smarter than Christian Bale. They don't catch him in an interesting way. They just get some woman to turn on him and you know, pressure to do it, and then they set a trap for him at the end. He's not recklessly exciting. He's not smarter than the cops for most of the way. He's kind of surrounded by idiots, and he does dumb, stupid things throughout the movie. So I personally would have liked a movie that sort of made him glamorous at first, and then you sort of saw – I mean, he's grabbing women and children – not children, but women and men to block himself as he runs out of a bank and get to his car. That's in the very first heist, and you start to think – yeah, you know what? This guy isn't such a cool character. You know, you're always sort of rooting for people when they try to break out of jail or if they're robbing a bank. But he's grabbing a woman and holding her as a human shield while he runs to his car. And I thought, great, maybe we'll have a movie where this guy seems glamorous and ultimately we grow to, like, despise him and be glad he's caught and killed. He's a gangster. He's a thug. He killed people. But they never really do any of that. He's just sort of a not very bright guy who ultimately gets caught.
Actually, a lot of critics are saying very similar things about the fact that there are so many, or too many storylines in the movie. That seems to be the main. But I don't know. I mean, how much do you think Michael Mann, the director, is at fault here?
Oh, he's totally at fault, 100%. Don't we all belong to the auteur theory? Sperling linked us to a great article about the great auteur critics like Andrew Saris and how they're all fading away and regular critics don't have jobs anymore. But people like Andrew Saris and Pauline Kael would hold Michael Mann. You know, he's wholly responsible for the film.
Actually, Ann Thompson was the source of that from Thompson on Hollywood. We can place a link to that in our show notes, a link to her piece, which actually highlights all of the pieces on film criticism or the decline of film criticism. Well, now, a movie we started talking about was The Proposal, and that, of course, stars Sandra Bullock and Ryan Reynolds. It rounded out the top five this week, making $10.5 million. It dropped only 18.3% and to date has made $113.7 million in North America on a budget that is at least publicly known to be about $40 million. So that is a huge hit and has definitely raised Ryan Reynolds' street cred in Hollywood. And it turns out that it's raised it so much that he's gotten a new movie. He's going to be a new comic book hero, The Green Lantern.
Or is he?
Well,
are you are you excited because he, Karen, because he was up against your buddy from The Hangover?
I do love Bradley Cooper, but I don't know. I think Bradley Cooper would have made a good Green Lantern too, I suppose. But Ryan Reynolds is in a place in his career where it makes more sense to put him in it. I don't know, though, because he's also going to do the Wolverine spinoff, so does he really need another comic book movie?
You know, I think I agree with Ann Thompson, once again Ann Thompson, from ThompsonOnHollywood.com. which is, I guess, still on Variety until August. But she writes here in her post about it, Ryan Reynolds, Bradley Cooper, and Justin Timberlake were all in the running. Clearly, Wolverine's Reynolds is the strongest, most versatile actor, and Warner Brothers and director Martin Campbell chose him. Martin Campbell will be directing Green Lantern. And then she goes on to say, my problem is, I don't care. The studios are digging into second-tier comics.
I totally disagree with that.
I agree with Karen.
If you talk to any fanboy, Green Lantern is their favorite.
Well, she says here, the studios are digging into second-tier comic properties that don't have the wide popular recognition enjoyed by Batman and Superman, and I would have to agree with that, although Iron Man, as she points out, did surprisingly well. And that was, for all intents and purposes, a second-tier comic property.
But the fanboys don't necessarily love the quote-unquote first tier. I mean, there's Batman Superman and Spider-Man, but they're like so obvious. You get the real fanboys who will go see these movies, love the Green Lantern, love Iron Man. They like them because they are second tier.
And I think anything that's done well will work. You know, it doesn't have to be, you don't have to have instant name recognition for a character. The Hulk is incredibly well known, but it's worked poorly as a movie. And Iron Man is awful. It's a billionaire capitalist, and he's stuck in a tin suit, so you can't even see his face, but they made it work. So Ryan Reynolds as the Green Lantern, can totally work. But
Ryan Reynolds has to be as interesting as Robert Downey Jr. was in Iron Man.
Well, you always want a great leading man. You want Tobey Maguire as Spidey. You want Christopher Reeve as Superman. That always matters. I definitely think Ryan Reynolds is more suited to Deadpool. That's the character spun off from X-Men Wolverine.
I agree with you.
Deadpool's a jokey guy who breaks down the fourth wall and talks to the audience, and he's very wisecracking, and it seems really well suited to Ryan's personality. But apparently they're delaying Deadpool because Green Lantern is getting priority.
You know, I do question whether the fanboys and guys in general are going to like Ryan Reynolds. They kind of, there's sort of a douchebag thing going on with him. That, you know, guys don't really seem to like him. Sorry, Storm, you can edit that out.
I think they're just plain jealous of him because, let's face it, he is the guy they all wanted to be.
No.
Could be. It could be his baby face, too, though.
Yeah. He just hasn't made
There's something he just seems inherently weird about him. I see it. I do see it.
But he seems jokey, and that works with Deadpool, and the Green Lantern, it doesn't work as well.
Yeah, I agree. I think Bradley Cooper would have brought a little bit more gravitas to it, but I don't think he has the name recognition yet.
No, I'd like to audition Justin Timberlake, though, I'll tell you that.
Really? You think he'd be good in this?
No, I'd just like to audition him.
For what?
Oh, I bet, yeah. I'll do it with you.
Well, like Deadpool,
I like how he ignores that.
this is me in my own head saying, "Moving on," and without actually saying it out loud. But my wonderful transition, which was going to be about how Deadpool was delayed, and so is a television show. A new television show called Parenthood, based on the Steve Martin, Ron Howard 1989 movie, is also being delayed, but this time it's being delayed not because of any network problems, and I guess it's going to be on NBC, but because one of its lead actresses, Maura Tierney, who is well known for starring in ER.
And News Radio.
She is ill, apparently, according to The Hollywood Reporter.
And yeah, and that's delaying it, which in itself is not much of a news story because I actually feel sort of bad, curious as I am as to, you know, wanting to know what's wrong with her. But it brings up the question whether parenthood is cursed, which in itself is sort of a joke, right?
Why would it be cursed?
Well, because back during pilot season, when they were shooting the pilot for this, they had an unfortunate event on the set of Parenthood in which one of the NBC vice presidents of drama, Nora O'Brien, unexpectedly died on the set.
Dear.
She had, I guess, an aneurysm, it's looking like.
Well, that's
very
sad. She
was pretty well-loved at that studio, too. It was very sad, actually.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully more of Tierney's illness won't prove as debilitating, though. Obviously, if they're delaying it to mid-season, it's of a fair amount of significance. But she's a really good actress. Tommy Shalhoub is the director on the show. He's done a lot of great TV, like The West Wing, and it's actually one of my favorite Ron Howard movies. After Apollo 13, I think it's my favorite movie of his.
Oh, I could not get through that movie.
they say here that production was supposed to start July 27th, but has been postponed for 8 weeks to late September due to, quote, the medical evaluation that Tierney is undergoing. And then NBC said, quote, we are unable to release further details and ask that you respect her privacy at this time, which we are going to do. However, we will tell you that Universal Media Studios and Imagine TV are producing the television show, which was meant to premiere September 23rd and run in the 8 p.m. Wednesday time slot. Now that Parenthood has been pushed, the new drama Mercy, which was to take over the 8 p.m. Wednesday slot in mid-season, will launch in the fall. The cast and crew of the medical drama have been summoned to start work immediately on the series so that they can debut
it. And
that
series looks pretty good, so this to me is not a bad thing.
And Parenthood, they tried to make it into a series once before in the, the early 90s, right after the movie. That didn't work. I'm not quite sure what their take on it is again. But big family sitcom. I really like Maura Tierney, though. I think she's a really good comic actress.
Oh, I love her. And she does drama equally well. She's just fantastic. She was so good in News Radio.
Well, this would be about the time that we would get into some inside baseball, some inside entertainment news story. But we are definitely out of time because we spoke to David Wilde, who was incredibly interesting, and we really owe him a huge debt of gratitude for coming to speak with us today. His book, He Is, I Say, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love Neil Diamond, is available for purchase today, probably through Amazon, so we'll link to that. He also contributed to the Rolling Stone special issue on the death of Michael Jackson. His writing can be found on the Huffington Post and in Rolling Stone, and of course you can follow him on Twitter. His handle is Wild About Music. We thank him for joining us. For links to any of the stories we talked about on today's episode, you can look up our show notes on our website, showbizsandbox.com. If you would like to email us, you can do so. The email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. We will review all of the emails each week and pick a few to read on air. If you would like to leave us a voicemail, you can do that as well. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's toll-free, 888-567-7263. You can visit our website to find out about all of our social networking links. We have a group on LinkedIn, a Twitter account, which is Showbiz Sandbox, all one word. We have a Facebook fan page, and you can submit news stories to us through Delicious, the social bookmarking site. Just tag any news story that you would like us to consider covering with Showbiz Sandbox, all one word. Once again, guys, Michael, I should say, Michael, anything you want to plug?
No, that's it. You can visit me at michaelgiltz.com, G-I-L-T-Z, or look me up on Huffington Post.
Karen, of course, can always be found at industrynexus.com. Anything else, Karen?
That is all I have to plug this week.
Okay. Well, until next week, play nice.